Thanks to Zita Aurora for organising this. It's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed all the talks. I know I've said that to some of you in person, but I'm saying it to you all now. It's been really good. And yeah, thanks for inviting me. I had trouble quite working out how to pitch this, because for some of you, you'll be really familiar with Fennell's work and others won't be. I'm in a philosophy department, and generally speaking, in philosophy in the UK, you don't tend to be taught about Fennell. So I'm sorry, some of this may be familiar to you, but I'm going to plough on regardless. Some of the work that I do in philosophy in phenomenology is kind of historically based, and partly what I'm doing with this is kind of some historical work, as in the sense of trying to sort of interpret some ideas, but then I'm also interested in sort of using those ideas and seeing what relevance they might have for other kinds of things we might be interested in our sort of current debates, I suppose. So there's a bit of both of those things. Okay. So I'm going to basically be talking about Fennell's ideas on the construction of race, and then what the implications of those are for working against race. That's what I'm going to be interested in. So, quick bit of background. You probably all know Fennell, but in case you don't, Frantz Fennell, psychiatrist by trade, was studying philosophy in France, in Paris, during the 1950s. Maybe in between the world wars as well, but I'm so crap with dates, never mind. Mid-20th century, hanging around with the likes of Sartre, Merleau-Ponty, Simone de Beauvoir, and then also thinkers from the African diaspora like Aimé Césaire, Senghor, lots of people knocking about in Paris during these years. And he was from Martinique, and which was an old French colony, and he was interested in thinking about how race was constructed in that particular colonial setting. What he tells us is that the racial categories are defined in contrast with one another. This might not be very exciting news, but you've got white and black. White, superior, civilized, intelligent, fully human, and so forth, and black, basically the opposite of those things, inferior, primitive, uncivilized, savage, etc. And I'm going to talk about white and black, but read that as white and black in the context of the colonial situation, because that's what he was talking about. And that obviously might extend to whiteness and blackness today, as we are living in a colonial, you know, a colonial world, but never mind. And then it's also part of this schema that whiteness has a special normative status. So the white person is in some sense the universal, the human, and the black person is a sort of crap version of the human. Now, what Fennell's interested in is how it is that this kind of racial colonial schema gets to become real. So it doesn't think this is based in any kind of biology. So the question is, how does it become something that's real? It's socially constructed, but how does that construction happen? And that's what I'm going to talk about. And it's constructed for Fennell through recognition, which is obviously a very sort of widely used concept these days in philosophy and political thinking. There are lots and lots of different ways to understand what recognition consists in. I think Paul Ricoeur has come up with, I think he's identified 24 different understandings of recognition that you find in the literature, which I'm not going to list for you. But roughly speaking, we can understand recognition in all of its different varieties as, in some sense, placing persons in the social order. So when you recognise somebody as an X, whatever the X is, what you're doing is assigning the person a place in the social order. And then different accounts of recognition also think other things, but we'll go just with that. Now, an interesting thing about the concept of recognition that's been pointed out by this thinker, Anita Chari, I'd be interested if anybody here knows other people who've addressed this, because you know, I think this is interesting. But she's pointed out that there's a tension at the heart of the idea of recognition, where recognition is supposed to be both factive and constructive. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm going to give you a toy example just to make that really clear. I'm going to talk about donkeys, but obviously when we're talking about recognition in political philosophy, we're talking about persons. It doesn't matter, let's just illustrate this tension. It's factive, recognition is factive, because when you recognise something as something, it's built into the concept that what you're doing is correctly classifying them. And they would have been that thing whether or not anybody recognised them as such. So the thing about the donkey, if you recognise a donkey, if my toddler recognises a donkey instead of shouting camel, which she shouted for all animals for a while, which was kind of hilarious down the park, it's a big ginger lurcher, she'd always shout, camel! I find that hilarious, but anyway. If you recognise an animal as a donkey, then it's part of that, that what you're doing is you're tracking the truth of that. They are a donkey, and they were a donkey before you recognised them, and whether or not you recognise them as such. But then recognition is constructive in theories of recognition, insofar as it's supposed to construct our social identities. So to give the analogy there, the thought would be that a particular animal only becomes a donkey because it's been recognised as such. You can hopefully see, what's obvious really, how these two things are in tension. Now, Chari thinks that this tension is, strikes right at the heart of ideas to do with recognition, such that the concept's kind of no use. She didn't quite say that, it's implied by her discussion. But I sort of think that this tension isn't as great as she thinks it is. And I think it's actually pointing us to something that's very important about appeals to recognition, which is that identities are formed in dialogue. So when people talk about recognition as part of a component of a system of social construction of whatever, they're trying to get at the idea that it's not just that there's an external that imposes some construction on the individual or the people, whatever we're talking about. Instead, there's two partners to this process. And in the case of social identity, there is the individual, and there's something about them that is being correctly recognised when they're recognised as an X. And yet there's construction insofar as this social identity is built up through dialogue. So the individual on their own isn't an X, whatever the identity is. They become an X through this process of dialogue. Now, that might sound a bit mysterious, but I'm going to move on to try and explain how this insight is cashed out in Fanon's work. Because there's different ways of understanding the contribution that the individual and society make to the construction of a particular identity. And what Fanon is going to try to show us, in fact I think he probably does show us, although there are many questions we might ask about his work, is how race is constructed through this dialogical process. And it's constructed in such a way that it works at the level of the body. So it's not just to do with intellectual ideas about race, it's to do with the body, but the way that he understands that means that he's able to not give a biologically reductive account of race. And he does it by using some ideas that he takes from Merleau-Ponty, who's another phenomenological thinker knocking about in Paris in these years, and Fanon was a student of his for a while when he was in Paris. So the idea that he takes from Merleau-Ponty is the idea of the body schema, and I'm now going to talk a little bit about that. It's an idea that we still use today, understood in different ways by different people. I'm going to be talking specifically about the way Merleau-Ponty understands it, to then show you how Fanon uses it and develops it to give us an account of race. So the body schema. Now, one way to get into understanding what the body schema is to begin, and this is the way Merleau-Ponty does it, sort of, as far as anyone can tell, is you could begin by sort of saying, well, what's your awareness of your own body like? And a sort of obvious answer that people, right at the beginning of inquiry on this, as it were, might be tempted to say is, well, we're aware of our body through perception. Body's a sort of physical part of the world. I can see this water bottle, can touch it, hear it, use my senses to, get a sort of a link with it. So isn't this how I'm aware of my own body? I can perceive it, so isn't that the answer? And Merleau-Ponty's answer is, well, yes and no, because of course we can perceive our bodies, he's not going to deny that. But our awareness of our own bodies isn't as straightforward as simply the perception of an object in the world, or even the perception of another subject in the world. And why not? Well, here's one reason why not. Your awareness of your own body, your sense of your own body, takes in more than just those things that you perceive, either currently or that you perceive often. So think about the back of your head. I can't even remember the last time I saw the back of my head. you know, I mean, I don't literally, you know, get my eyes round to that. Obviously, I see it in a mirror, probably when I went to the hairdresser, that was ages ago, probably so. So the back of your own head is a part of your body that it nevertheless forms part of your sense, your awareness of your own body, but it's not a part that you often perceive. Your face, obviously, we tend to see our faces in mirrors, cameras sometimes, we see our faces quite a lot, but we're not constantly perceiving our faces. Nevertheless, we've got a sense of what each of our faces looks like. You can carry on for the other bits of your body that you don't perceive very often. There's also other features of your bodily experience which are kind of strange. How much time have I got? I'll mention one of them. The way that the boundaries of your body, as you are aware of your body, can kind of expand and contract to take in things like tools that you use on a regular basis. The classic example is the blind person's stick. If you habitually use the stick to get around the world, the thought is it becomes a kind of extension of the body. So that again shows that the body isn't quite the same as an object that you're perceiving in the world. The sense of your own body is more than that. There's other ways as well, but I'll leave those aside for the sake of brevity. So how is it that we're aware of our own bodies? What gives us a sense of our own bodies in the world? And Merleau-Ponty's answer to this is a large part of it is to do with our motor skills. So these are just physical abilities, things we can do with our bodies. They range from very, very simple things like being able to scratch your nose, through to things like being able to walk, through to things like being able to drive or use a computer. One of those things that you do with your body, he classes as a motor skill. And motor skills have got two components to them, according to Merleau-Ponty. There's both the motor component, so the thing you can do, and he thinks that the thing you can do affects the way that you see the world. Because for Merleau-Ponty, you don't perceive the world just neutrally as having size and shape and colour and so forth. You see a world which invites you to act. You see a world of affordances, is a term that's sometimes used. A world full of possibilities for action. So when you walk into this room, you don't just see a load of green, oddly shaped objects scattered around. You see chairs for sitting on, things that invite you to sit down on them. So every motor skill has this for Merleau-Ponty, a motor component and a perceptual component. And he thinks that your skills, how you can interact with the world, give you a sense of what kind of body you've got. So if you think just about that last point I made, that we see the world in terms of possibilities for action, so we see a chair as for sitting on, he thinks it's part of that if you see a chair as inviting you to sit on it, it gives you an implicit sense of yourself as being the kind of bodily being that can sit on a chair. And that's not conceptual, it's not like a sort of conscious thought. When you walk in, see a chair, you don't think for him, I could sit on that, therefore I'm a sitting down kind of being. It's all just kind of built into your awareness of the world. So, motor skills, for Merleau-Ponty, are what make up your body schema, what give you a sense of your own body. They give you a sense of the kinds of things you could do in the world, they give you, obviously, the capacity to do those things, and they also give you a sense of the kind of being that you are. Yeah, so that pretty much just says what I've just said. The body knows, in inverted commas, because it's supposed to be something implicit, not constituted by beliefs. It knows itself in terms of its capacities for action, and he uses the idea of the body schema to capture that. So people sometimes distinguish between the body schema and the body image. Not really clear whether Merleau-Ponty's into any of that distinction, so I won't talk about it. You can ask me about it in questions if you're interested. But the thought is that your body schema is both a sense of yourself as an enduring, embodied subject of a particular sort, so the kind which is made up of your sort of capacities, the motor skills you've got, the kinds of things you can do. It gives you a sense of the kind of body that you are. And then there's also a kind of ongoing awareness of your bodily self and the kind of changing movements of your limbs. I've put configuration of bodily parts, but it means like you're changing position. And that kind of there's an interplay between these things. The sense of the kind of thing you are affects the way that you experience your body moment to moment, and then the way you experience your body moment to moment affects your sense of the kind of thing that you are. Okay. So, Fanon then takes the idea of the body schema from Nalapunti, and he says we need to add to it more notions if we're going to understand the experience of the colonised black man. And then, of course, this may extend to other types of folks as well. But Fanon gives us the idea of the historical racial schema and the epidermal racial schema. It's unclear whether these are supposed to be the same notion with two different labels or two slightly different notions. The way that I read Fanon, I think he's talking about a single phenomenon and he has two different labels for it. You might disagree. But the thought is that the body schema, as Merleau-Ponty describes it to us, there's some truth in that, but it doesn't get to everything there is about our sort of sense of our own bodies. And so what Fanon wants to add to this when he's thinking about the construction of race is that there's also a kind of body schema which is made up from stories, stereotypes, myths and so on, which is associated with black people in the system of white colonial power. There's also an analogous system of myths associated with white people in the system of colonial white power, but he's thinking specifically about black people. And what he argues is that colonial thinking, the way that race becomes concrete, is by affecting colonised people's implicit sense of their own bodies. It gets built into the body schema, is what he's suggesting. And one effect of this, there are others, but this is just one that I'll outline for you so that you can kind of see how this is supposed to work. The body's sense of its own possibilities for action are affected. So how does this work? Well, you can hopefully see, maybe, I realise I'm going quite fast, but you know, maybe you're still with me, I don't know. But Merleau-Ponty's argued that our sense of our own bodies is constituted by our motor skills. The things that we've learned how to do give us a sense of what kind of body we've got. And we get our motor skills through interacting with the world. Motor skills are skills of doing stuff. And what Fanon adds to this analysis, which Merleau-Ponty takes very little notice of in his discussion of this, is that the world with which we interact is a social world. There's other people in it. So some of the things we learn how to do through interacting with other people. And even when we're not directly interacting with other people, our behaviour is sensitive to social norms, so rules about how people should and shouldn't behave. And some of the things, some of the skills that we learn depend on our being treated a certain kind of way. So to give just a sort of straightforward example of a teacher, in order to build up skills of teaching, the practice of teaching, if you like, the set of embodied skills that make up doing that thing, you've got to be treated in a certain way by people. I can't teach unless anyone wants to sit and listen to me. You know, I need students to sort of recognise that I'm you know, that I am a teacher in order for them to sit and listen to what I'm saying and sort of take it in, question it. But for that activity to happen, I can't do that in a vacuum. I need other people to be involved. Another kind of example of the way that social norms affect our behaviour is an example which is from discussions of Merleau-Ponty, but the example of shuffling and lift. What this example illustrates is the way that social norms work on the body at a level below that of conscious thought. So if you imagine getting into a lift with other people in it, as you get in, everybody kind of shuffles around until everyone's standing the socially appropriate distance from everybody else. And no one thinks about it. If you ask anyone what is the socially appropriate distance, they'd be very hard pressed to tell you. I mean, at best, you'd kind of be able to go this far, but actually to state it is, I think, impossible. Maybe you could if you study sociology, but the thought is you have this implicit knowledge of this social norm and you then act in accordance with it in a way that kind of bypasses conscious thought. Now what Fanon is pointing out when he's talking about the historical racial epidermal schema is that in the colonial world many of the social norms are racist. That's one of the points. So these come out in all sorts of different ways. These are just three examples. There's a physical division of space, so literally physical division of the landscape. This might be formal, as in the apartheid, between, you know, literally places that were legislated as where black people were allowed to go and where white people were allowed to go. It may be more informal, something like a ghetto area where there isn't a legislation, no law saying, you know, you folks can only live here. But nevertheless, you still get this division of space. So practices, habits, motor skills, things we do, ways of interacting with the world are supported by an arrangement of space. The practice of dividing people up into citizens and non-citizens is supported by a whole range of physical arrangements of space, like borders, passports and so forth. Then there are also norms of comportment, ways that one should behave if you're a black person. So the one he talks about is you're supposed to always be smiling. No matter how badly you're treated, you're supposed to be smiling. Slaves are supposed to be smiling and so forth. And then there's also the way that other people react to you, which affects the way that you sort of construct your body schema. In order to understand that last point, he talks about the gaze. So you're probably familiar with this. You often find it in talked about in connection with Sartre's work. And the thought here is that basic thought, coming under the gaze of somebody else is an uncomfortable experience, and in some way it fixes your identity. And there's different ways to cash this out, but Sartre's example that he tends to use is that you're caught peeping through a keyhole, so you're suddenly aware of somebody else seeing you, so being under the gaze, you feel shame, and that shame is the awareness. I've put arises from suddenly appreciating, but for him it is actually the awareness of how you appear to somebody else. Now, when Fanon takes up the idea of the gaze, he was influenced to some extent by Sartre, who was a friend of his, but he was also working with ideas that he develops from the work of Simone de Beauvoir, although he never references her. Lewis Gordon has said, naughty Fanon, he should have done. But he is also influenced by Richard Wright, who influenced Simone de Beauvoir, so there's a sort of community of people working on this idea. And this is where the epidermal bit of his account comes in. Race, for him, contains a reference to biology, but not in the sense of a reduction to biology, not in the sense of a claim that there's anything innate about racial characteristics, but nevertheless, biology is taken up and lived in the construction of race. And he sees this, maybe obviously, although maybe people would contest this, having thought about it further, as being to do with primarily skin colour, at least in the context that he's talking about. But the thought is that you're recognised on the basis of your skin, and being recognised as a black person then means lots of myths and stereotypes get attached to you. There's lots of expectations about how you should behave, so this is the way that recognition fixes identity. And it also affects affect, so the way that people feel towards you and the way that you subsequently feel towards yourself. Now I'm going to skip to this quote from Audre Lorde, which Shiloh Whitney uses to illustrate what Fanon is talking about. I'll quickly read it for a few minutes. So this is Audre Lorde describing an encounter that she had on a subway train when she was a little kid. I think she was about five. The AA subway train to Harlem. I clutch my mother's sleeve, her arms full of shopping bags, Christmas heavy. The wet smell of winter clothes, the train's lurching. My mother spots an almost seat, little gap between people, and pushes my little snow-suited body down. On one side of me, a man reading a paper. On the other, a woman in a fur hat staring at me. Her mouth twitches as she stares, and then her gaze drops down, pulling mine with it. Her leather-gloved hand plucks at the line where my new blue snow pants and her sleek fur coat meet. She jerks her coat closer to her. I look. I don't see whatever terrible thing she's seeing on the seat between us, or probably a cockroach, but she's communicated her horror to me. It must be something very bad from the way she's looking, so I pull my snowsuit closer to me away from it too. When I look up, the woman is still staring at me, her nose holes and eyes huge, And suddenly, I realise there's nothing crawling up the seat between us. It's me she doesn't want her coat to touch. The fur brushes my face as she stands up with a shudder and holds onto a strap in the speeding train. Born and bred a New York child, I quickly slide over to make room for my mother to sit down. No word has been spoken. I'm afraid to say anything to my mother because I don't know what I've done. I look at the side of my snow pants secretly. Is there something on them? Something's going on here I don't understand, but I'll never forget it. Her eyes, the flared nostrils, the hate. And Shiloh Whitney uses this to interpret some of what Fanon's telling us about the moment of recognition for the black colonised man in white France. He draws on the Freudian conception of horror and phobia. So as I said at the beginning, he was a psychiatrist, so he was steeped in these ideas which were kind of popular at the time. But the thought is that the overwhelming affect in the colonial situation is horror. So rather than shame, which Sartre sees as the feeling of being under the gaze for everybody, Fanon argues that the feeling of being under the gaze for the black colonised person is horror. People are horrified, and horror has the Freudian meaning of being both revulsed and fascinated. And he goes on to talk about this as part of an explanation of the idea of the black person as hypervisible, which is connected to some of the things I think Aidan was talking about earlier, but I'll leave that because I want to finish in the last few minutes by asking, well, given that framework, the way that the racial colonial system, conceptions of what people are like, are kind of lived through the body, how do we undo them? So what's Fanon's answer to this? Let's skip those slides because they're just summaries. If we want to undo the colonial racist order, so if we want to undo race, then what we need to do for Fanon is to undo the colonial body schema. So how are we going to do this? Well, one thing that you might think, and he sort of talks about this a little bit, is that given that the practices, the habits, the motor skills, the ways of interacting with the world that get embedded in the body, that turn bodies into either black or white bodies, that turn bodies into racialized bodies, given that those are supported by the physical configuration of space, then one thing that needs to happen is a reconfiguration of physical space. So Fanon talks at one point about the way that in colonised countries you get this strict division between where the colonised people live and where the colonial people live. So this is a quote where he's talking about this from The Wretched of the Earth. The zone where the natives live is not complementary to the zone inhabited by the settlers. The two zones are opposed, but not in the service of a higher unity. Obedience to the rules of pure Aristotelian logic, that is a philosophical joke, guys. They both follow the principle of reciprocal exclusivity. The settler's town is a strongly built town, all made of stone and steel. It's a brightly lit town, a well-fed town, an easygoing town. Its belly is always full of good things. The town belonging to the colonised people is a place of ill fame, peopled by men of evil repute. A native town is a hungry town, starved of bread, of meat, of shoes, of coal, of light. The native town is a crouching village, a town on its knees, a town wallowing in the mire. So we're going to need to change the physical configuration of space, but we seem to be stuck in a bit of a chicken egg situation, because you might think, well, how is space going to change if the practices don't change? Which do we change first? So it also gives us some indications of how he thinks we should change practices. And here, Fanon often talks about the redemptive power of violence. He's being criticised for this, and wrongly, I think, but I'm not going to try and argue this here. But I think we should distinguish, which I don't think anyone tends to do, but I think we should, between what he says about the redemptive power of violence, which may or may not be correct, there's an argument to be had there, and instead the importance of struggle. I think he's talking about two separate things which we should keep apart. I'll put violence on one side, because there's only a little bit of time left. But the reason that he thinks struggle is important to undoing the racial binary and undoing the body schema, well, one reason is because old habits, old motor skills, old practices can be upended through struggle. Because what you get in a situation of struggle is an extraordinary situation where the old habits and practices don't apply. So you have to build up new ones out of necessity. And in A Dying Colonialism, he gives us five case studies where we can understand him arguing basically that this goes on. So one case study he gives us is of the doctor in Algeria. I'm doing the title. I'll briefly read this to you and explain what he's talking about here. So he went to work in Algeria. He was working as a psychiatrist there, and at the hospital where he was working, I think he was like the head psychiatrist of the unit, he was treating both Algerians who'd been tortured by the French and French who'd been torturing Algerians. And after a while, he decided that this was an untenable position to be in, and he resigned and took up the cause of fighting for Algerian independence. Introduced into Algeria at the same time as racism and humiliation, Western medical science, being part of the oppressive system, has provoked in the native an ambivalent attitude. With medicine, we come to one of the most tragic features of the colonial situation. The fact that this is something that could really help people's lives, but the Algerians are turning against it because they see it as an imposition of colonialism. Fanon then tells us that this changed because medicine was used as a weapon during the fight for independence. So the French tried to stop medicines which were crucial to sort of treating wounded fighters, things like anti-tetanus vaccine, antibiotics, ether, which was used as pain relief during surgery, were all denied to Algerians. And the few Algerian medical professionals then went to great lengths to acquire these for the Algerian people as part of the fight for independence. And Fanon says what this gives is basically an upending of old practices. You'd previously got a practice where Algerian people, if they were ill, they wouldn't consult the doctor. They didn't see that as a possibility that was part of their world. That was something for the French white people. So you've got this practice that is one of the things that's dividing people into these two races, Algerians and colonisers, French. And then through this situation of struggle, you've got a breakdown of this practice so that then Algerians come to start consulting doctors. So Fanon talks about that in this passage, where he says the Algerian doctor, the native doctor, who, as we've seen, was looked upon before the national combat as an ambassador of the occupier, was reintegrated into the group. Sleeping on the ground with the men and women of the Mishnas, living the drama of the people, the Algerian doctor became a part of the Algerian body. There was no longer that reticence, so constant during the periods of unchallenged oppression. He was no longer the doctor, but our doctor. So, just finally, what I think this gives us, if I think there's truths in what Fanon tells us. The way that colonial structures are now constructed may be different, but that truth that socially constructed identities work through the body, I think is true. And I think that what he tells us about upending old habits then gives us some insights into some of the things that we should do if we're interested in anti-racist work or combating any other kinds of like social identity that we think is oppressive for whatever reason. And what he tells us basically is that it's no good thinking and talking about it. You've got to do something else. You need to do some body work. And the next bit of this project that I'm working on is to start exploring some of the types of bodywork that people have talked about in connection with this kind of issue. There isn't time to go through these now. I'll mention just one, which is somatherapy, which has been developed by Brazilian psychiatrist and anarchist activist Roberto Freire, no relation to Paulo. And somatherapy basically uses play, games, sound, cooperative movement exercises in order to try and undo things that have been written into the body by the oppressive regimes. It's not unreflective, because as well as doing these things, you have to reflect on what it is that you're doing. But it is seems like exactly the kind of thing that is kind of implied by Fanon's conception of racial identities. Okay, I'm going to stop there. and see if anyone's got any thoughts or ideas about that.